circumcision of the heart was always the intent through loving obedience. And Christ became the circumcision, the minister of the circumcision, that you and I, in following His Spirit, would obey His Word. Will you? Will you change your want to? We have a lot to talk about concerning this matter of the law of the Spirit. We'll do it on another occasion. I'm so glad that you've joined us. Remember, we're all lawbreakers here, and God wants to change our want tos to love Him with a whole heart and display that by our love for Him and our love for one another. I hope you're doing that. Thanks for joining us. Become a partner. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Don't wait for the other guy to do it. You do it. Let's do this thing together. We'll see. God bless.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IR and its advertisers or affiliates.
This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for this next hour, they're going to be your views as well, because this is Open Line Wednesday, and we're just going to be talking here until you start calling in at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. And of course, today we saw a rather dramatic drop in the stock market associated with oil reaching an all-time high, and certainly on the New York Commodity Exchange, and well, there are three major exchanges. On two of those exchanges, oil hit $123.80 a barrel, very, very close to $124, and I believe it's on the way to $150 for gasoline, and with that, of course, will come a $6 a gallon gasoline. And you must understand that this is not happening by accident, it's happening by intent. There is plenty of oil. We are not running out of oil, contrary to everything you hear. And if you go to the Department of Energy, they will tell you of the mass deposits of oil, the massive deposits of coal we have, which can be converted into oil. Certainly, they knew how to do that in Hitler's Germany. When I lived in South Africa, Sasol, the South African country, was creating most of their oil out of coal, and we could do exactly the same thing here. instead of course taking corn and converting it to ethanol, having to subsidize it about 50 to 60 cents for every gallon because it's not economically feasible to do it. In the meantime, running up the price of corn and in a world where, of course, there's beginning to be shortages of food. Now we're destroying food so we can create ethanol, whereas we could produce it out of grass or all sorts of other things. We could produce ethanol out of anything we wanted to. Corn is the most inefficient thing we could produce it from. Certainly Brazil has almost their entire automotive fleet on ethanol, and they can create billions of gallons of this every year, and we won't let them bring it into the United States because we have high tariffs against it, so it won't be competitive. Why? Well, because Arthur Daniels Midland is the biggest producer of ethanol in the United States, and they're making a fortune, and they've got a lot of good friends back there in Congress. So instead of doing anything, the logical things, instead of allowing drilling in the Alaska Wildlife Reserve, so-called ANWR, why, we're told, oh my goodness, we would interfere with the pristine nature of that. Ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing up there but the reindeer, and they love, of course, the oil pipelines because it keeps them warm during the wintertime, and there's no pristine wilderness up there. It's simply frozen tundra most of the time in the Alaska Wildlife Reserve. And the reason we're not drilling there has nothing to do with preserving the ecology. It has to do with the fact that the establishment wants to create artificial shortages so they can raise the price of gasoline so they can get you out of your car. That's what it's really all about. And all you need to do is go back and read the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, which we summarize in our Sustainable Development Syllabus. But you can probably get summaries up on the Internet, or you can buy it at Cambridge University Press, Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, and Agenda 21 coming from the United Nations, and they will tell you they want to really get this common folks out of our cars, get us onto bicycles. Of course, the elite are going to have their planes and their private jets and their luxury cars and their gas guzzlers like Al Gore does and Arnold Schwarzenegger does. They just want to get us out of our vehicles. Understand, we're moving towards a society where you have an elite and you have the common folks like you and me. Our number 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you'd like to give us a call. 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you anything you'd like to talk about. But we're having really some very, very serious financial problems. Did you know that 1.5 million Americans' homes went into foreclosure last year, the year 2007? 1,500,000 American homes went into foreclosure last year. So far this year, in the first quarter, it was actually 650 to 660 thousand American homes went into foreclosure. Did you know that there is the potential for between 8 and 10 million American homes going into foreclosure? And if you figure each one of those is a family of four, you're really talking about, say, 40 million people suddenly finding themselves homeless or having difficulty finding a place to live. We're the greatest financial crisis America has seen. And, of course, that is simply the first bubble. The first bubble is the housing bubble. The second bubble is going to be the credit bubble, and, of course, all the assets that are out there. And, of course, the third bubble is going to be the derivative bubble. And here you're talking about somewhere between $600 and $700 billion, and there's not that much money in the world. I mean, all the money in the world is probably not more than $45, $50 billion, and yet why they're talking of a derivative bubble of somewhere $600 to $700 trillion, and we're in real trouble. Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Missouri. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Doctor?
I'm doing just fine. Good to hear from you. You have a question or comment?
Well, I happen to hear on the History Channel today it's the anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania. And I've heard you mention that several times, and you know, with everything going on, I didn't know if that thought had crossed your mind.
I did not even know that this was the birthday of the or that terrible tragedy, or the anniversary of that terrible tragedy. But of course, the Lusitania was intentionally sunk. Our leaders, and of course, the High Lord of the Admiralty in Great Britain, a man named Winston Churchill, wanted to get us into the First World War, and of course they knew that if they could sink the Lusitania and kill a lot of Americans, they could use that as a justification for getting us into the war. And even though the Germans had actually advertised in our newspapers, placed ads saying, don't go on that ship, it's a ship of war, any passengers there will probably lose their lives, the State Department told them to go ahead, hang on, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That 1-800-544 line is the order line. You can call and get your orders placed there. But the 1-888-24-LIBERTY is how you can reach us here during the programs. And otherwise, there's not anybody on the to answer the telephone there. But 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to engage in open lines. And Jim had just called in from Missouri. And he was commenting that on the History Channel today, he had learned that today was the anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania. And that would have been certainly in May of 1915. And certainly in May of 1915, they wanted to get America into World War I. And there was a reason why they wanted to get us in, why Winston Churchill, who was the High Lord of the Admiralty in Great Britain, and of course, a man named Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was Secretary of the Navy here, and of course, the leaders of the United States, wanted to get us into World War I because that was going to bring us into this world government. And they felt that out of the carnage and horror and terror and brutality and inhumanity of World War I, the people of the world would be willing to give up their individual freedom and join this world government, which was to be the League of Nations. And actually, as a result of World War I, of course, you had a revolution in Russia, brought in communism, you had a revolution in Germany, you had a revolution in Turkey, you had a revolution in Italy, and of course, all these countries' governments were disrupted. The people of Europe were quite willing, of course, to go ahead and accept a world government because certainly there were over 20 million people who were killed in that senseless war and probably twice that many were wounded and would carry the pain of their wounds to their death. But the difficulty was that the Americans, who really had lost 125,000 men but still had not been that deeply hurt, did not want to go into world government, and so the League of Nations failed, and that's why they had to create World War II to bring about the United Nations. And then of course after that, when the United Nations did not become the world government they sought, that's why they're moving us towards World War III. Anything else you'd like to say, Jim?
No, sir. I've just heard you mention that on several occasions and just thought you might. You know, I know everyone doesn't get to listen all the time, and I thought it was good you were able to review the circumstances.
Well, really what happened was the Germans kept running ads in the American newspapers, or trying to run ads in the American newspapers, saying, don't go on the Lusitania, don't go on the Lusitania, we're going to sink it, because it's not a passenger ship, it's a ship of war, it's going to be carrying munitions. And the State Department sent out orders that the newspapers were not to carry those advertisements. And, of course, when William Jennings Bryan, who was the Secretary of State, learned about that, he demanded that that restriction be lifted. And then, of course, this was one of the reasons why he resigned as Secretary of State, because he realized he didn't control the State Department. Somebody else was controlling it. And of course, when passengers who were going to get on the Lusitania would call and say, you know, is it safe to travel? They were assured by the members of our State Department officials that it's perfectly safe to travel. You go ahead and get on that ship. And then they set the Lusitania off with about 1,000 passengers, about 150, 120 of them were Americans. And of course, then they set the ship as it was approaching the area where the German submarines were known to be operating, why the captain was ordered to go at half speed, you know, to save coal. Of course, that makes it a much better and easier target for the German submarines captains. And then the other thing that they were told to do was actually to there was supposed to be a destroyer escort there, and the destroyer escort was withdrawn so that the ship would be sunk and would go down. That's what they had planned, and they left those people there to die. And about 100 Americans lost their lives, and you know, probably two or three times that many British people. But they were quite willing to sacrifice those lives because they wanted to get us into the war, just exactly as they'd gotten us into the Spanish-American War by pretending that the Spanish had sunk the battleship Maine, as they got us into Pearl Harbor by the attack at, you know, the Second World War, by the attack at Pearl Harbor, by the goddess into Vietnam, by a phony Gulf of Tonkin incident, which didn't occur. And I'm really very, very concerned that they're going to come up with a feigned attack over there in the Persian Gulf to get us into a war with Iran and the whole of the Muslim world. So it's like deja vu all over again, Jim. Anything else you want to say before I let you go?
Well, one quick thing. I happen to hear Webster Griffin Tarpley speaking tonight, and he said they were making such a big deal about Obama, and yet the states he's winning are states he'll never win in the fall.
Right.
He won't win North Carolina. You know, Hillary will be more likely to win. Let me rephrase that. The Democrat might win in Indiana. Won't win in North Carolina. Just, he went down the list, these various places that Obama is winning now, but he won't win.
All right,
in
fine.
The fall. I live right near Kansas, the state. I live in Kansas City. President Bush probably got a higher percentage in Kansas than he did in Texas. You know, so even though Obama won the primary in Kansas, he'll never win. Trust me, he will never win the general in Kansas.
Well, but you have to understand, Jim, that there's an invisible force behind Obama. And they're really pushing him towards the presidency. There is an invisible force. They're pushing him towards the presidency. And of course, this is going to become apparent before very long what it's all about. It may very well be that they want Obama to be the Democratic nominee, because that's the only way they'd ever get people to vote for John McCain for the presidency. I think that they want to have a democratically controlled House of Representatives and Senate and a Republican president. I think that's the plan. But right, we're just going to have to wait to see how the whole scenario unfolds.
All righty.
God bless. Thanks very much for calling in. Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty fair. Tonight I wanted to talk about Bobby Kennedy, since you have been talking about him for the past couple of days. And
friend, in fact, we're putting together a four-tape set on his assassination. Four-tape set.
I wanted to talk about him in relation to Marilyn Monroe's death.
All right.
She kept a diary, ever, it's well known, and she had a relationship with Bobby Kennedy as well as Jack Kennedy. And the thing was that she was passing, she knew secrets that they told her, and she couldn't keep her mouth shut. And I believe she was murdered, and I believe Bobby Kennedy had something to do with it. And I'm pretty darn positive. There was a neighbor of Marilyn Monroe named Elizabeth Pollard who made a report to the FBI several months after Marilyn's death that she saw Bobby Kennedy and two plainclothes LAPD officers come to her house, you know, because she could see her through the window. She was playing cards at the time. She saw them coming up to Marilyn's home. And of course, they did wiretap the bedroom, and and there was some conversations between her and Bobby that indicate that Bobby was looking for this book, and she wouldn't tell him where it was. And there were other things involved, and some horrible, horrible stuff that they did to that poor woman. You know, the real hero was Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, he really was.
He was a nice good guy, and I really respect that guy a lot because he wouldn't let any of those Hollywood people to a funeral. And the other thing, too, is that he would not talk to Frank Sinatra for the rest of his life, you know, because of what his involvement in the thing, because he was a horrible man.
He really was.
He was a horrible man.
And because he was part of the mafia. You have to understand that Marilyn was having an affair with Jack Kennedy. She had an affair with Bobby Kennedy. She also had an affair with Sam Giancana.
Yes.
And probably one of the best analysis of what happened is in a book called Double Cross, written by Sam Giancana's brother. And apparently Sam was there the night that she died. And she was despondent because Bobby Kennedy had broken up with her and just told her that he couldn't have anything more to do with her. And apparently she really had been put upon. She was being used by men. She understood that none of them cared for her. You're having an affair with the head of the mafia and the president of the United States and then with his brother, and then you find out that you're simply a piece of meat as far as they're concerned. We will never know the truth. All we do know is the fact that that diary has never been found. And I believe, of course, that the Kennedys sent somebody over there to get the diary. The last thing they could afford was to have that information made public. That would have ruined Bobby Kennedy's political opportunity to run for the presidency. And the tragedy is, of course, maybe it would be better if it found that he hadn't run for the presidency, because that's why they killed him. He probably would have been the Democratic nominee for the presidency.
He probably would have
become president of the United States, and they could not allow that any more than they could allow Jack Kennedy to remain in power.
Yeah, and you know the other thing too. Another interesting thing was that Marilyn was good friends with Dorothy Kilgallen.
Right.
And of course, Dorothy Kilgallen knew quite a bit about the Kennedys. And unfortunately, you know, she also was very vocal. And when she interviewed Jack Ruby, she was writing a book called Murder, she was writing a book, and then she ended up, you know.
She ended up, of course, being suicided.
Yeah,
as
right,
well.
Yeah. Like
anyway,
say.
Hey, thanks very much, Ray. It's good to hear from you. And our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 464-8295 right here in Santa Cruz. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. We'll be back in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, we've got Ed calling from Calgary. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Dr. Stan.
How is it coming in up there in shortwave?
It's clear as a bell.
Yeah, that's good. Well, of course, that's a great station we're on, of course.
5.875. It's coming in clear as a bell.
Okay, great.
And your opening comments there talked about the food shortage, and I thought I'd have to give you a call.
Okay, fine. What's happening to the wheat crop up there in Canada?
Oh, well, we're waiting for summer. Right now, we're getting snow. Again in Calgary. Dr. I sent you?
Yes,
About Winnipeg, Manitoba? Could I maybe make my comments on that?
You go right ahead.
Well, I told you that I thought it was significant about the super corridor that's being built between Mexico and Canada.
Right.
And the northern terminus being Winnipeg. And I happen to know that Winnipeg is quite a hub in Canada. It's got the provincial legislature building, which is basically a Masonic temple. It's also the home of the Canadian Mint. It's the home of the Canadian Pacific Railroad. And more significant than that is the Canadian Wheat Board. The Canadian Wheat Board is a government-run monopoly whereby the farmers have to sell their grain products to them, and they in turn pay the farmer and distribute it around the world, or whatever, domestic. But anyway, since writing that letter, I kept thinking about this, and what does Mexico need that Canada has? And I'd say food.
Right.
Like that Mexico City is just a baby factory, and here's a super corridor being built with the ramps being walled off and little towns turning into ghost towns, et cetera, et cetera. And it just spells bad news for America.
I think
they're forecasting food shortages and the riots and all that stuff that's going to come to America, and they're going to get shut out. You are going to get shut out.
You mean
Mexico's
going to get all your wheat
rid of? Here's a corridor, and the best way to move food, and it includes the beef, controlled temperature meats and stuff like that. The best way to get it to Mexico is down by truck.
Right.
And here, I'm just thinking, you know, why is this corridor being built?
Well, I really think, of course, it's being built to disseminate the Chinese, products throughout the United States, throughout Mexico, and throughout Canada.
Right.
But basically, what we have done is transferred our manufacturing to China. We've encouraged our major manufacturers to go over there. We've lent them the money. We've given them the guarantees in case that their factories were nationalized, that the major American corporations would get not only what they'd invested, but perhaps two or three times that if they were fortunate enough to have their plants nationalized by the Chinese communists. So why would you do anything like that? Well, because, of course, the whole idea is to lower our living standards, to raise the living standards in China, but they've got to be able to distribute those products. And, of course, they don't want to leave themselves susceptible to the longshoremen in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Seattle are the major ports, so now they're going to be able to bring them in through Mexico and then, of course, ship them very, very cheaply right on up through Mexico and disseminate these products throughout the United States and continue destroying the industrial base of our nation, because the people who buy the things that's cheapest, whether it's made in the United States or elsewhere, and it's a lot cheaper to make things in China than it is here in America. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we have Ed calling from Calgary, and he's simply saying, of course, that, we get a lot of our wheat from Canada, and ordinarily they're waiting for spring to come. Right now, they're in Canada. They've got snow on the ground there, but they should be getting, has the wheat crop in, yet, Ed, is it in?
Oh, I'm not up to that at all. I can't say.
All right, fine, because I know there's certainly nothing. The
storms like you wouldn't believe. I don't know if the farmer's getting his crops his seeding any or not.
Well, like we do know in the United States, the farmers had the wheat crop in, and then, of course, the whole area flooded, and the whole area around the Mississippi, a lot of it's still underwater. And so we may very well lose almost our entire wheat crop here in the United States this year. Certainly, they're going to be losing a lot of their wheat crop over in Africa and Asia. The wheat crop is not coming in Australia because of the continued drought. We have no reserves at all as far as wheat is concerned. We've disseminated those throughout the world, and there could very well be shortages of wheat here in the United States. There could be shortages of rice here in the United States.
Yes,
there could
it doesn't
be shortages
look good, Dr. Stan.
What's that? Go ahead.
It doesn't look good. You know what? Most Americans, they take us for granted. In fact, a lot of them think that we're part of America, and that's good, because we are your closest friend and your closest neighbor, and also we are your biggest trading partner.
Well, of course, we have a great deal in common with our Canadian brothers. We speak the same language. We have pretty much the same heritage. The only trouble is you've let the wicked people take a lot more control of your government than they have here. We're trying to catch up with you, but right now we haven't.
Well, thank you for taking this call, Doctor, and God bless you.
Oh, God bless you too, Ed.
Good night.
And keep us posted as what's going on up there in Calgary.
Yes, keep your eye on Canada, because Canada has its eye on you.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. All right, that was Ed calling from Calgary. Our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Canada is a fabulously wealthy country. It has oil. In fact, what most people really don't understand is we don't get much of our oil from Saudi Arabia, probably less than 10%. Our major sources of oil imported comes from Canada, Mexico, Venezuela and Nigeria. That's the sources of our oil, other than what we do not produce here. We've got plenty of oil. We can develop it, but it's not allowed. We can't, of course, we're not drilling up off the north slope of Alaska, where, of course, there's probably far more oil than there is in Saudi Arabia. Our good friend Lindsay Williams, I talked to today, he said that there is a massive, of course, oil field up north of Anchorage. Wouldn't have to even drill offshore. It's right there in Alaska, but that is, of course, information is not being allowed out. Certainly we know we have massive oil deposits off both the east and west coast of the United States. And the oil companies have been very, very clever. Of course, they finance the environmental movement that finances the efforts to stop offshore drilling. Why? Because they want shortages so they can run the prices up. It's just that simple, and people don't understand. The oil companies pretend that, oh my goodness, we have nothing to do with the price going up. When Lee Raymond, who was the chairman of the board of Exxon, retired in about 2005, I believe it was, 2004, he got a bonus, what he quit, of $400 million. $400 million to Lee Raymond, who is the president of the Exxon, chairman of the board of Exxon when he retired. That's pretty good payment, don't you think? But, of course, Lee Raymond laid the foundation for the artificial shortages that we're seeing today, and the fact that in the fourth quarter of last year, Exxon made more money than any other corporation in the world has ever made in the same period of time. I've forgotten how many billion dollars it was, 30 or 40 billion dollars, something like that, in that one quarter. And, of course, the oil companies are making out like bandits, saying, oh, shucks, we're having nothing to do with this. The rising prices has nothing to do with us. We're just fortunate we're making all these massive profits here. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is simply to confuse you on the issue. They know exactly what they're doing. But even beyond, of course, even beyond the great profits, is this planned effort to raise the price of gasoline so high that people are not going to be able to drive their cars. To get the price of diesel so high that the farmers won't be able to plow their fields. So that the truckers won't be able to actually drive their trucks and distribute the food. So that the airlines, of course, are going to have to keep raising their prices higher and higher until actually air travel becomes literally inaccessible. And, of course, you're seeing that increasingly today as the airlines are having more and more problems. And none of this is happening, by accident. It's happening by intent. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, our open line evening, Wednesday open line. We've got Dale calling from Moses Lake in Washington. Hi, Dale. Have you called before?
No, I haven't. I just finally got your number after trying several times, but I wanted to bring your attention to, I just recently got a magazine. I'm a retired carpenter out of the union, and they have a article in the Carpenter's Magazine, which just came out, the recent one. About Alberta and Edmonton, they supposedly have the largest known oil reserves, estimated 1.7 trillion, 2.5 trillion barrels of oil. Of course, it's that tar sands up there, but they're calling for 500 carpenters at Fort McMurray up there in Alberta, and they need some in Edmonton, too, because they have a large reserve there, too. But now that oil has reached over $100 a barrel, it makes it worth their while to, they've been going on with it now for several months, or a year, back to a year, I think, now. I've seen it on public broadcasting, also. And another thing I'd like to bring your attention to is, when you had, Joseph Smith on here recently on the,
fact that
George Washington was a member of the Masons.
Right.
I have an article here that I read recently, by Dr. James Kennedy. He was interviewing Dr. Morey, who had researched and found that George Washington did join as a Mason, but after he did get into the Masons, he He more or less rejected every honor that was conferred upon him, and he, as a young man, and was later not interested.
I think you're absolutely right. Actually, we have a letter that George Washington has written where he was replying to somebody, and I think it was about 1798 he was writing, and said, you know, I haven't been in a lodge, you know, going for 30 years. So certainly the Masons want to claim him, but he certainly was not dedicated to Masonry. I think he was a good American. And
he was Episcopalian.
Right.
According to the
book
on the presidents that I have, and also they come out recently with an article in the U.S. News and World Report with a picture of him on the front page. Secret Societies is the title of the front page with him, with a picture of him in masonry garb, and it says he never did set for that that particular picture.
I think you're absolutely right, Chris. I don't trust U.S. News and World Report, but on this I'll have to agree with him. The Masons try to claim him, but, of course, yeah, I don't think he wants to claim them. Hang on, this helps. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY out across America and the world, or 464-8295. That's 464-8295 here in the central coast of the United States, or I should say the central coast of California. And Dale was calling from Moses Lake, saying that, of course, although the Masons claim that George Washington was a Mason, why, of course, Dale's contention is that George Washington, although having been a member of the Masonic Lodge, certainly, really, as he grew older, had nothing to do with it and more or less rejected their basic tenets. And I do believe that is absolutely right. In fact, I was commenting that we have a letter, and we could certainly, in one of our newsletters, we actually refer to it. We have copies of it. It's up on the Internet, where George Washington, about 1798, somewhere in there, is writing and saying, you know, I certainly do not agree with it. I have not been involved in Masonry for 30 years. I haven't been to a lodge meeting. So I think that that's really the truth. So there's so much confusion about Masonry, and of course when it began to have its occult foundation, it's always had an occult foundation. But the average Mason does not understand that Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity, an outer fraternity of men having a good time and trying to do good things and using the secret society and handshake. It's sort of intriguing, but there is an inner fraternity. And those are the people who understand the arcanum and canorum. And if you wonder what those terms mean, it is a secret and the secret of secrets. And the statement I just quoted comes from Manly P. Hall's book. I believe it's Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. And, of course, we actually carry that book. We offer it through our ministry. And you can find the exact reference to the page in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, quotations from Manly P. Hall. So the average Mason has no idea of the occult foundations or the occult goals and objectives of the secret society that they are part of, but they are being used by the people working behind the scenes who have a really nefarious goal, and that is the destruction of the Christian foundation of our nation and merging us into this one world government. Anything else to help?
I'd like to say one thing. It seems to me that lately there are those that would want to distort the history of America by claiming false truths about our founding fathers.
You're absolutely right.
And I'd like to say that people should be aware and don't believe everything you hear or read. Sometimes all that's needed to establish a false truth, a simple so-and-so said so. So let's don't be influenced by every doctrine or book that's now on sale at your local bookstore.
Well, in fact, you know, Dale, they've taken over control of the publishing houses in America. They're all being bought up, so we have fewer and fewer independent publishers, and the books that they put out simply are to control our reality, having nothing to do with truth. And, of course, what they want to do is control our perception and make us believe things that just are not true. And probably, unless you know, of course, the publisher, why you're going to be misled. And I get books all the time on the CIA. And, of course, they pretend to be giving the inside. They're not at all. They're really covers for what the CIA has done. I get other books on the establishment. and they're written by people who are part of the establishment, but they're to confuse us as to the fact that there really is a secret group that controls America, and they will never mention the fact that, of course, all of their ideas originate within the occult, and there's a spiritual force that motivates them. Anything else, Dale?
Well, I'd like to say God bless you and to keep up the good work, and maybe I'll call in again later.
He would love to hear from you again. God bless. Thanks so much. And
bye.
That was Dale calling from Moses Lake. That's the first time he's called. And let's go to Dennis calling from Michigan. Hi, Dennis. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
You have a question or comment?
Yeah. In regards to the NAFTA Super Corridor Highway.
Right.
The Autobahn. Now, the 10% Truth History Channel had a program saying that Hitler built that for his war effort.
Right.
Do you suppose maybe the superhighway might be Bush's Autobahn?
You know, I hadn't even thought of that, but certainly we know that the American government built the highway from the Soviet Union into Afghanistan years before, of course, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan using the highway we built so they could attack that country.
Well,
and, of course, you may have something there that I had not thought of it, but certainly I would not put down the idea at all.
One thing I'm curious, History Channel, which I put very little credibility in most of what they have to say, but they said that the Autobahn was 27 inches thick of concrete.
Right.
Where our highways average 11. And I'd be really interested to know what the schematics were for that NAFTA highway.
Isn't that be interesting? Because you wanted to have a very heavy cement so you could move your tanks over that. And
mm-hmm.
your tanks and your... I don't think they had armored personnel carriers, but they did have tanks at the time. I used to drive on the Autobahn when I was stationed in the military in Europe, and I will tell you, they were wonderful, wonderful highways. And, of course, over there on the Autobahn to this day, there's no speed limit. You can go 100 miles an hour on the Autobahn if you're foolish enough to do it.
Supposed to be one of the safest highways in the world.
Yeah, they really are very, very well done.
Anyway, I got a Rick satellite.
Oh, you did? Are you enjoying that?
It's unbelievable.
But for our listeners, basically Radio Liberty is on satellite. That's Telstar 5, and if you're having any difficulty getting our programs, don't have access to the Internet, you can get a satellite from Rick, and Rick's a real person. And, of course, then you can listen to our programs 9 hours a day, and you can also listen to Joyce Riley, who's on 9 hours a day, and Chuck Chrismeyer and Butch Paul. And we have this. We put it up there to get the information. And are you listening to any of the other programs on Telstar 5 or primarily our site?
I scoot around, but primarily yours, but I hooked it up myself. It's very simple. Anybody out there listening should look into it.
All right, fine. I appreciate that, and I think it's $169 for the... what did it cost you, recall?
$169, and I got a locating tool from him for $14, which was almost $100 in different trade magazines. And it beeps when you hit the dish, the satellite, and it's just the simplest thing in the world.
Well, he's an honest man. We get nothing out of it at all. Joyce and I are in this to get the information out, and she does a great job, and so does everybody else on our network. Hey, thanks very much for calling, Dan.
You're welcome. Bless you.
Let's go to Gary, who's calling from Union Gap, Washington. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And let's go to Gary calling from Union Gap. Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Very well. Thank you. We're blessed and blessed to be able to get your program. I've got two questions tonight.
Go right ahead.
The first question, you heard the program on the assassination of these different people, John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Lincoln and different ones. Very interesting program. What was that? Was that Monday?
Well, let's see. One day begins to merge into the next one. That was Galen Ross in his book, The Elite Serial Killers. And, of course, it covers all of the things that you mentioned, and that program was actually Monday evening at 8 o'clock, and it's up there on the Internet if anybody wants to hear it.
Yeah, well, my question is, Dr. Stan, my wife and I have wondered this. why, surely, John Kennedy knew that he was not pleasing the establishment by his policies of the silver certificates or whatever it was, and why would he drive in that perception with an unprotected car? I mean, surely he knew his life was at stake. Why would he just take away the glass shields and all that stuff and just be so unprotected?
I really can't tell you what was in his mind at all, Gary. I will tell you that ordinarily, of course, when the president is in an open car, there are a Secret Service agents running on either side of the car. If you've ever seen the Zapruder film, there are no Secret Service agents there. Somebody pulled him away and left him open ready to be assassinated. So that's, you know, why he did not insist on having something protected. Maybe he just figured God was going to look after him, and I have no idea. Maybe he had the ego. Obviously, he had a tremendous ego. He wasn't afraid to go ahead and be having all sorts of sexual liaisons when he was the president. Maybe he felt he was above the law, or that there was no way they could get to them, and he was very, very foolish.
Wow. The second question, I think, isn't President Bush expected to go to the to Jerusalem in May this month?
Yes,
and do you think it's possible that he might be able to sign, you think he really will be able to sign an agreement with the Palestinians in regards to Jerusalem and possibly the Temple Mount?
No, I really don't think so. I don't think that they're going to be able to negotiate any sort of an agreement. There's too much animosity between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It'll be very interesting to see what happens, but I would not be overly optimistic that there's going to be peace in the Near East during a lifetime. In fact, I think that we're moving rapidly towards an escalation of tensions and probably towards a war in that region in the next year or two.
Well, you know, the scripture talks about Daniel, you know, and Daniel, you know, it says they're going to sign an agreement where the temple will be rebuilt, and we're fast approaching the seven-year mark, 49 years since they took Jerusalem in 67. If it was signed next year, it would put us, 7 years before 2016, which would be when the scripture says would be the return of the Messiah.
Well, Chris, we don't know it's in 2016. We can't actually tell the time when it's going to happen. Jesus told us no man knows the time or the date, so we're just going to have to wait and see. But you know, there's so many things today that go along with the prophecies. I mean, the return of the children of Israel to the Holy Land, the fact that they were prophesied that they would be using the shekel as far as their currency, that suddenly the Hebrew language coming back after being dead for such a long period of time. Simply the fact that Israel is there certainly is a fulfillment of prophecy, and there's so many other things that were prophesied. The increase in knowledge, we're having so much increase in knowledge in the latter days. The fact that we are now living at a time where they really would be able to keep people from buying and selling, you know, unless they had a credit card or a mark or something else of the sort. The fact that they actually have these electronic chips that they are injecting into animals and a lot of human beings now on the experimental basis. I believe that we're moving towards the fulfillment of prophecy, but I'm not going to come out on a limb and make any sort of predictions as when it's going to occur, because there's nothing worse than when you're out in the limb and you see a guy with a chainsaw climbing the tree behind you.
Well, that's good, Dr. Stan. I share that in a degree, but I do want to say that the Bible does say you don't know the day or the hour. It said, of the times and seasons, brethren, ye know.
All right. Well, of course,
we don't want to set day or hour, but I think the scripture can let us know if we study prophecy. It can at least let us know close to the season. But I appreciate your comments and your show, and I'll still be listening, and I'm telling a whole bunch of people about you. So God bless you. Appreciate you very much, and we pray for your protection.
God bless. Thanks so very much, Gary.
Well,
let's go to Carlos is calling from Carson, California, and our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And hi, Carlos. How are you doing?
Very good. It was great seeing you here a month ago here in California.
Right, because we enjoyed being down there and giving those talks.
Yes, great. It was great to have you down here. But, Dr. Stan, you know, the more I look at these weather cataclysms, the more I'm inclined to believe there is some weather manipulation going on. Look at what happened yesterday, that cyclone that killed 22,000 people. It just so very conveniently happened to hit at the area that harvests rice.
Right.
Now, that particular country is an exporter of rice. Now it's gonna withhold its exports, and of course that's going to contribute to the increase in food prices that we're already seeing.
Right.
In Mexico last year, the storms that hit Mexico last year happened to hit in some of the main agricultural areas. They were devastated.
Right.
And consequently, you saw the consortium of international agricultural companies flood in there and start taking over the farms that were devastated. Remember Hurricane Mitch that devastated Honduras, Guatemala. What happened right after the fact? A week after Hurricane Mitch in Guatemala, the international corporations descended immediately within a week after with already made plans for privatization of its water and other resources. You look at the tsunami that hit 2 years ago in Indonesia. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, prior to the tsunami, were trying to get the natives to leave the pristine areas there to vacate them so they could start building the resources and all this, and they refused to leave. Well, so happens as soon as the tsunami hit, all these people were displaced, many of them were killed, and sure enough, the resorts started going up immediately.
Sort of like down in New Orleans, where they wanted, of course, to get rid of all those blacks from the in the area so they can put in their casinos. Isn't that right? It's just a coincidence, so I want you to know it's just a coincidence.
These are all coincidences, Dr. Stan. I mean, there comes a point where you've got to say, wait a minute, there's a pattern here, there's something wrong here.
Let me comment, Carlos. If we really looked into this in great detail, if we have a great DVD put out by our friend Bob Fletcher on weather control. We have a book written by Jerry Smith on weather control. We have certainly other material on HARP, the ultimate weapon. That's a dreadful of a book, but we have 4-tape sets on it. And then, of course, we have a 4-tape set on weather modification. They can manipulate the weather. In fact, if you go back and read Zygmunt Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, it was published back in 1970, and for anybody who doesn't know who Zygmunt Brzezinski is, he's one of the three most powerful men in America today. Zygmunt Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, and they both work for David Rockefeller, who really runs everything from behind the scenes like the master manipulator he is. But Zygmunt Brzezinski, writing in 1970 in a book called Between Two Ages, and the last time I looked at it on the internet, it was $150 for a copy. But there, on about page 59, somewhere between 55 and 65, at a footnote at the bottom of the page, he talks about how in the future we're going to be able to create storms and droughts. Now, that was 1970. And he also talks about how they're going to be able to create chronic disease, and believe me, they are creating chronic diseases. We have all these new chronic diseases, and nobody knows where they're coming from. Oh, shucks, Morgellons disease, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, Lyme disease, AIDS, Ebola. Well, where did they all come from? And why are they plaguing humanity today? And yet we know back in 1970 they were talking about how they're going to be able to create new diseases. And believe me, they are creating new diseases. And I believe that they do create storms. And I believe, of course, what they want to do is bring about the fulfillment of Revelation 6:8. And I look, and behold, a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death, and Hades followed close behind. Hey, Carlos, hang on. We'll be back in just a moment with Radio Liberty. Okay, Carlos, anything else you want to say before we let you go?
Well, yes, I believe that the New World Order will use the weather as one of their main things of decimating the world's population, ultimately.
I believe you're absolutely right.
Dr. Stan, I'm very curious why the CIA is moving to Denver, why the World Oceanic Institute is based in Denver instead of out here in California somewhere, and why the the name, I believe, of the building where they are being housed at is NOAA, N-O-A-H.
Well, maybe they know something about what's going to happen that we don't know. And if first of you see an arc, that start to build an ark, why, you'll know what they have in mind.
They have something in mind for the west half of the United States here?
I think
Western California coast?
I think you may well be right. I do not know what's up, but I do believe that they are working to fulfill that Revelation 6-8 prophecy, where they're going to destroy a quarter of the population through famine and through disease and through war and the beasts of the world, so beasts of the earth. So I think it's only a matter of time. We see this whole scenario unfolding, the idea that there could be ever food shortages in the world. A year ago, everybody would have said that's foolish. The fact that they could be actually coming up with new diseases that would kill off literally hundreds of millions of people seems impossible, but I don't think it's impossible. The fact that we could be moving towards a world nuclear war, which will kill hundreds of millions of people. I believe that we are going to see the fulfillment of that prophecy. Why? Because the people on the other side, the Luciferians, know the prophecies, and they're working to bring them to fulfillment.
Exactly, Dr. Stan. Well, you know, moving to another topic real quick, when we look at our three candidates and then we look at their financiers, we can see a pattern here. You look at Barack Obama, whose mentor is Brzezinski, of the Trilateral Commission, who's under David Rockefeller, the One World Government guru.
That's Zygmunt Brzezinski. We were just talking about him a moment ago. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then we look at McCain, who was recently in London at Spencer House, and the Rothschild sponsored that event.
Right, it was a fundraising event. I bet he raised a lot of funds from the Rothschild's friends there.
Exactly. And then we look at Hillary Clinton, whose husband used to be financed by Steven Zink, which was under the Rockefeller domain. Right. So no matter where we look at, all roads lead to world government.
Amen to that. Hey, thank you so very much for
calling. Okay, Dr. Stan, good evening.
God bless, and I really appreciate your comments, and I think you're right on. I think that something big is in the offering. We're going to find out very, very soon. And, of course, that was Carla's colleague from Carson, California. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, Elizabeth had called in from the Monterey area to ask about what's the best way to prepare for food storage, water, water filtration, first aid, and medicine in case of an earthquake. And I would say certainly you should be prepared not only for an earthquake, but for massive fires. You should be prepared for an epidemic. And I really do believe, if you read the material that they're being put out by the elite, that they are planning on using diseases and, of course, trying to round people up and force them to be vaccinated against diseases and epidemics that they've created. I think that you should be prepared for nuclear warfare. I think you should be prepared for chemical warfare. I think, first of all, there's a DVD which we carried called Sheltering in Place. It just tells you how you can use your home to protect yourself in. And then we actually have a book. It was actually one time put out by the Office of Civilian Defense. We don't have an Office of Civilian Defense any longer, but it talks about nuclear war survival skills. We have a 4-tape set on civilian defense. And then, of course, we have a book called Making the Best of Basics. How do you survive if you don't have all the conveniences we have today? And how would you prepare wheat? How would you, if you had wheat, or how would you prepare other items, and how to store water? But I would simply suggest that the best way to store water is to have a 55-gallon barrel, and you can get plastic barrels or wooden barrels, and fill them full of water, and you put a little Clorox in there. They'll last for 5 years. And then, of course, you need to have water filtration, something like the Big Berkey or Berkey Light units here in California. You can't get the Big Berkey. You can get the Berkey Light, and it would be an ideal way of purifying water if there were real problems, if you were close to any sort of a water source. And then, of course, emergency food, probably better to have dried food. There's nothing wrong with laying in canned food, but what you really want is to store that food in a cool place. We do actually have a relationship with Ready Reserve Food, which is dehydrated food that's packed in nitrogen. It'll last 10 to 15 years if kept in a cool place, And so there are ways, of course, to do this. The Mormons have a cannery. We actually went there ourselves. I don't know if they'll still let people go in there. But this is a way of canning food. You can learn how to can it yourself. But I think the dehydrated food you want to have, or freeze-dried food. And if you need more information, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And simply ask for a catalog, an emergency food catalog. I will tell you that shortages are developing. In fact, the people we work with are telling us that they're having difficulty now for the first time getting food. Never been like this before, but certainly they're having difficulty getting rice. They're having difficulty getting many of the staples that they need, of course, for the kits that they put together. And we're only talking about over the last month, suddenly shortages are developing. So if you're going to do something, don't put it off, because let me tell you that all across America, people know that something seriously is wrong and are concerned that something very, very bad is going to happen. When is it going to happen? I don't know. But I think you ought to be prepared because, of course, once it happens, it's too late. You're not going to be able to go down to the store and get the supplies that you need. And, of course, we're going to be offering a special emergency radio when I get around to getting them ordered. That's a great little radio. I'm quite impressed by it. And then, of course, we hope that you'll certainly want to get lay in a supply of health products. You should have the vitamins and minerals and all the things that you need. If you have an illness and you need to get medicine, right now, of course, your insurance company will only pay for, enough for a month. You should have enough for a year, and you may have to pay for it yourself, but believe me, when you need it, why, you'll give any amount of money to have it. So start thinking ahead. What do you need for yourself? What do you need for your family? Start making preparations, because believe me, the government has made preparations for the elite. And there are simply places, bunkers here. There's one up in Santa Rosa for the elite, but there's nothing at all for the average individual. So, again, our number 1-800-544-8927, and then we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming at you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Barry Shamish. And for those of you who do not know Barry, Barry is a... Well, he's sort of a legend in his own time over there in Israel. He's been writing and trying to tell the people over there what's going on in his country, in Israel, for many, many years, for the better part of two decades. He was an investigative journalist. He's written, 9, 10 books, something like that. But, of course, he actually had created so much turmoil over there, of course, pointing out the fact that Rabin, the Prime Minister of Rabin, had been assassinated in Israel. by, of course, their counterpart of the FBI. There were a number of murders that had been carried out by government agencies over there, and people were listening and people were believing, and so eventually, because of the threats on his life, why Barry came to the United States. And Israel's loss is our gain, because Barry's with us on a regular basis, but telling us the stories of things that you have never heard before, and beginning to explain this whole incredible situation that we're seeing over in Israel, where the United States funds Israel, and then we fund Israel's enemies. We're funding Egypt, give them $3 billion a year. And Egypt, of course, is doing everything they can to prepare to attack Israel. And then, of course, we're selling sophisticated weapons to Saudi Arabia. Certainly radio-guided or certainly guided bombs. Why would we sell that to Saudi Arabia? Because if there was a war over there, they might very well be used against American forces and American troops. But this is nothing new. We built up Adolf Hitler before the Second World War. We built up Russia after the First World War to create the best enemy money could buy. We're building up Russia and China today in preparation for war. We're transferring nuclear technology to Pakistan so they could get a bomb. That's a Sybil Edmonds story. But I believe that we're looking down the line to a terrible, terrible war in the Middle East, and a war with the Muslim world, and this is going to affect Israel when it occurs. But right now, let's listen to what Barry has to say, and he's going to bring us up to date of what has happened this last week or two over there in Israel. Hi, Barry. Thanks very much for being
hi.
With us. Go right ahead.
Well, I'm going to interject something. I spoke with your engineer, and he brought up very interesting points. Do the leaders of Israel have a conscience? And, you know, that's a heck of a point. And I just answered, in all the time that I can recall since the Oslo Accord and since the rise of terrorism to unheard of levels, since it's been proven to most Israelis to be a mistake. I've never heard an Israeli politician say, I'm sorry. I've never heard one say, we made a mistake. I want to apologize to my people. Our intentions were good. I've never heard any contriteness from Israel's leaders. And it just occurred to me that that must mean they have no conscience. Well, I heard music already.
Well, it may very well be the point. And the great tragedy is, Israel is headed by corrupt people. Olmert, who is the prime minister of Israel, is now being questioned by police because, of course, of financial shenanigans and bribery and all of these things, financial misfeasance. Olmert very well, the prime minister of Israel, may very well be forced out of office because of criminal activity. And this isn't the first time he's been investigated. It may very well be the last one because it's very, very serious charges. How would you like to have our President of the United States being investigated for graft and thievery and all these things? Well, of course, it's not going to happen here, but it's happening over in Israel right this very day. We'll be back in just a moment with Barry Shemitz here at Radio Liberty. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, what you were talking about is a kind of push-pull that seems to have taken hold of the country. And now let's talk about the pull. And that's Condoleezza Rice was in Israel 2 days ago, 3 days ago, I guess. And the government did they made her trip very happy by endangering the Israeli people the way she wants the Israeli people to be endangered. We spoke last week about roadblocks and Ehud Olmert's red line that he would not lift the roadblock that separates Beit El from Ramallah. And we spoke about how they were neighbors. We're talking about a few yards, really, literally. You get to the junction, you turn right, you're in Beit El, you turn left, you're in Ramallah. And Beit El has 7,000 residents, plus a large army base. And Barak said, no, he's not going to remove that roadblock. Condoleezza Rice comes to the country, he has a change of heart, and he removes, I guess it's the most central roadblock in Judea and Samaria. It doesn't exist anymore. Lucky Palestinians, they can go on that road with all the weapons they want, and no one's going to stop them. It's just really, from a defensive point of view, it's sheer insanity. But they did that, and they did lots of other things, just as Condoleezza Rice was somehow, she's got the goods to threaten the Israeli government, and the Israeli government caves in every single time. And I'd like to know exactly what, I mean, there's endless possibilities for blackmail, but I'd like to know what she's using. Two little things that happened for Condoleezza Rice's visit, which of course had no protests. And she was welcomed to the country like a reigning heroine, though she despises Israel and Jews, and it's very obvious to people who know her that she wants Israel to go down. Nonetheless, the government, first of all, ordered two soldiers. These are the Kalamish brothers. Their incident was that a band of Bedouin camped outside the school.
Barry, hold that thought. We're going to just bring our other stations on board here, and then I want you to tell the story about what happened. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is simply pointing out that Condoleezza Rice went over to Israel, and of course, one reason, one thing the government's done to try to prevent terrorists from attacking Arab terrorists, from attacking the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, was to have roadblocks where they could actually stop cars and search them. Well, there is a town called Ramallah, the center for the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the capital of the Palestinian group, and very close by there's another Jewish town, and there's been a roadblock there, so you couldn't go back and forth between them without having your car checked. And certainly Olmert had steadfastly refused to remove that roadblock under pressure from the United States, and just this last week, he actually removed the roadblock, so now the Jewish settlers have absolutely no protection. Such as the armies pulling out protection, they're disarming the settlers there so they can't defend themselves, and now the roadblock is gone, and Condoleezza Rice is making all sorts of demands on the Israeli government, which they're carrying out, and of course, as a result, what they're doing is endangering the lives of every Israeli living in the West Bank and the Judea and Samaria area. So, and then, of course, there was another tragic situation that developed involving two brothers who were members of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. And you pick up that story, Barry.
Yeah, well, they were doing their duty. There used to be a program between the Army and the settlers that reduced the number of soldiers needed to stand guard on Judea and Samaria, and these two brothers were in that organization. It's called Mitzav. It's not important. And they simply asked the Arabs to get lost. You can't camp here. It's not your land, and there's a school there, and you can't do it.
These are a group of Bedouins, a band of Bedouins, right? About 20
right.
of them?
And so they were attacked. 20 of them started walking towards them, throwing rocks, and they were in danger. So they shot in the air and on the ground to get these people away from them. There was no attempt to actually shoot anybody. And, well, what do you know? This is always the case. The Israeli police, always in any dispute between an Arab and a Jew, will back the Arab, provided, of course, the incident took place in Judea and Samaria. The night before Condoleezza Rice arrived, I believe, they were told to report for jail, the Kalamish brothers, for kangaroo court isn't even, it doesn't begin to describe what they went through. They had an Arab judge who threw the book at them, and I guess it's to make Rice very happy that when a Jew defends his own land and his own people against intruders, they sit in jail for 9 months. And this lesson is well entrenched in the youth of Judea and Samaria and the religious youth of Israel who have family living in Judea and Samaria. I mean, there's 300,000 people there who also have relatives who live in Tel Aviv and Netanya. And they're sick of the army. They're sick of the Israeli state. And we know that because the army sent a group of officers to meet the high-ranking rabbis of Judea and Samaria to try and get some faith back in the army. And it's not going to happen. The rabbis told them that if you stop throwing people out of their homes and start acting like you're protecting us and so on and so forth, you'll get respect, not till then. You're just watching another country develop in Israel, a country that does not trust the Israeli army, and that is very, very serious. And finally, well, a little background. There were four synagogues in Bnei Brak, an Orthodox neighborhood, vandalized and arsoned this week. They were burnt to the ground. And this is in Israel. Now, what does the government do? Condoleezza Rice is arriving. They take a bulldozer and knock down a synagogue just outside Hebron. Chazon David was the name of the synagogue. It was built to memorialize two Hebron Jews, one on the city council, murdered in terror acts in the year 2001. But what makes this incident unique is it was on Arab land, and the sheikh of the clan announced publicly that the Jews have the same right to Hebron as the Arabs do, and he told peace now, Israeli leftists, that they're not welcome on his land if they're going to harm the synagogue. This synagogue could not have been more protected from the Arabs if you planned it that way, but the army didn't care. They came in with a bulldozer, and while in Bnei Brak synagogues are being burnt to death, in Hebron the army is taking bulldozers and knocking down synagogues. I mean, these Jews, they have not caught on that there's a war against them, and I don't understand why. But I'm going to give you one example. There's only one protest group in Israel. That's the Women in Green. And, well, they toured the synagogue after it was torn down. By the way, on the eve of Israel's Independence Day, no less. And they took pictures of the soldiers. They took pictures of the soldiers who were there to deal with the worshippers. And what they're planning, they're going to put the pictures on the internet, and these soldiers will not be welcome in any synagogue in the world. First of all, it's quite likely they don't go to synagogue. And secondly, nobody tunes into the internet to the Women in Green site to identify the soldiers. It's not a plan. And I wrote them back that night. I wrote Nadia Matar is their leader. I said, you've got to come up with another strategy. That's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. They destroy a synagogue and you put their pictures up on the internet. You've got to take action that's equal to their action. If they destroy a synagogue, I hate to say it, but you've got to destroy them in some way. But it's like talking to the wall. I mean, it's hopeless. But now we go to the pull. That was the push. Somebody is trying to bring down Olmert. And this is, I'm reading the reports about the Long Island businessman who dealt with Olmert, and he's willing to turn state's evidence, and they've got proof. What was amazing is that Olmert's mistress, Shula Zaken, was also arrested. Okay, she's the office manager. But she was put under house arrest and ordered to speak to no one by phone or any other means about this case. They took Olmert's mistress and they locked her under house arrest, and they spread the rumor that this is going to bring Olmert down. It'll be the end of Olmert. Now, I want to add something very important, and maybe someday we'll talk in depth. Olmert's former finance minister, Avram Hirshhorn, was indicted in an Israeli court last week, this week, and he will sit in prison for terrible bribe-taking, terrible blackmail, and this is just extortion, but apparently millions of shekels while he was finance minister. He got busted this week. So on the one hand, the Olmert government is doing everything possible to destroy any normal life in Judea and Samaria. On the other hand, somebody is taking action against Olmert and his people to make their lives hopefully be spent in prison. So that's what's going on in Israel, in a sense. There seems to be something under the table. Somebody seems to be fighting back, and Olmert seems to be a victim of, well, somebody offered $1 million, this was a month ago, for any information that could bring down Olmert. Apparently this is all connected. There's an under-the-table war going on, Olmert against the religious, especially against the West Bank, and then others against Olmert. And that's the unhappy state of affairs of Israel right now. So we quickly summarize this week's news.
All right, fine, Barry, and I think it's fascinating and tragic situation with a degree of corruption at the highest level of the government, and of course the fact that the leaders of Israel seem to be intent upon betraying Israel, and of course knocking down synagogues. Why would they possibly want to destroy synagogues? I think they're doing everything they can to break the spirit of the Israeli people, so that when this next war comes, there will be certainly nobody who's willing to fight and die to preserve your land. And I'm sure many people in the military must be extremely disillusioned.
Oh, they're furious. When that roadblock, the Beit El roadblock went, and by the way, it wasn't the only roadblock. The Yatta roadblock outside Hebron was also lifted, and also the roadblock between Jenin and Nablus was also lifted under Rice's order. The army are going crazy.
And, of course, the orders are coming from Washington, D.C., and anybody who thinks that the Zionists control Washington, D.C., look and see what's happening and ask yourself, why would the Zionists be doing that to Israel unless they want to destroy Israel? Either they're not very good Zionists or they have another agenda, and I'd like to suggest they do. I believe that there is an organized, orchestrated effort to destroy the land of Israel, and, well, I think this whole situation is coming to a crescendo, and, well, the not-too-distant future. We'll be back in just a moment with our good friend Barry Shavitz, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Barry, you picked the story up from there.
Well, we're going to do the story of where the Oslo Accords actually came from. Now, in retrospect, and, you know, I never talked about these things when I was living in Israel. I was too busy reporting things, and people were too busy giving me new information, and I never looked at the retrospect really how frustrating it was. Actually, until you brought it out of me, I never spoke about these issues. But I had an article, with Joel Bainerman, by the way, in the National Review, which is an accomplishment. It's the most famous conservative magazine in the United States. It appeared in the March 14th, 1994 issue. They called it Peres's Gambit. Our title was Balin's Secret Meetings, but we exposed, with a tremendous source too, Yeshua Meiri, we exposed where Oslo came from. Now, Yossi Balin was Shimon Peres' deputy. He's the head of the Marist Party today. He's an awful little pipsqueak who's doing terrible, terrible damage. Now, he had four meetings with the PLO when it was illegal to meet with the PLO. The first was on June 11th of 1991, and we'll get to Yeshua Meiri shortly. He witnessed the second meeting. But nonetheless, on June 11th, the Labor Party delegation arrived in Cairo, and Shimon Peres gave Yossi Beilin a letter that was intended to arrive in the mailbox of Yasser Arafat. He had a meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, okay, today's PLO president, and Saeed Kamal, who was then Arafat's number one aide, in the King Hotel in Cairo.
And it wasn't Mahmoud Abbas at that time, what, number two man in the PLO? What?
I think Saeed Kamal was higher than he was.
All right, go ahead.
They were both high up. The exact positions, I don't think are that important right now, but that's who we met.
Now, for our listeners, of course, Abbas today is the man who leads the PLO, in contrast to Hamas. But this is going back to 1991, and Abbas is meeting, and this other fellow are meeting with the representatives of the PLO, and that's against Israeli law. You're not supposed to do that, and yet they went ahead and did it. So pick up the story, Barry.
Well, Peres was the foreign minister. If you want to talk true blue, I mean real treason. There was a law against this. This was treason. You're not just using that word for dramatic effect. They were committing treason. Now, Peres' letter told Arafat that if you gather the Arabs of Israel to vote in the upcoming elections, and you get them to vote Labor, and they had an ally, the Rats Party as well, that was permitted, we will offer you the following deal for your support.
And I want you to hold that thought. We're going to bring our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Barry Sidney telling us about something that happened back in 1991 when Abbas, who is the current head of the PLO, at that time he was an assistant to Yasser Arafat and another one of Yasser Arafat's members, highly placed in the PLO, had a secret meeting with, of course, a representative of Shimon Peres, who at that time was foreign minister. And, of course, that was against the law. There was a law in Israel at that time. You could not, if you were an Israeli citizen or if you worked for the government, have anything to do with the PLO. But Peres had an idea, and he figured that he was going to get to be the prime minister of Israel. And so tell what this special deal was that Peres offered to Yasser Arafat at that time, really a treasonous act to mobilize the Arab voters of Israel to vote for the Labor Party, and that would eventually lead to, of course, hopefully to Peres's becoming the prime minister. Pick up the story.
Well, he certainly thought that. Now, a little background, we already did the Shas Party and how Peres blackmailed their leader, Aryeh Deri, and Peres was now foreign minister in a split government. Shamir was now prime minister. It was a tight election in 88, and for the first 2 years, Peres was going to be the prime minister, and then the next final 2 years, Shamir was going to be prime minister, except when it came Peres' turn to turn over power, he didn't play along. He didn't stick to the deal, and he really blackmailed the Shas Party into failing the government. Israel had no government in the year 1990 for 88 days, but eventually Peres failed in his mission to become prime minister. So immediately, and by the way, I guess that's in your archives. It's certainly on my website, that show we did about the Shas Party. But when that failed, Peres came up with a new beauty, and that was as we said, on June 11th, 1991, Balin gives the letter to Saeed Kamal and Mahmoud Abbas. One, okay, here it is. Farah says, if you gather the Arabs together, the local councils, the sheikhs, and the vote labor, we will, one, promote a settlement freeze. Two, we will switch our diplomacy to a land for peace policy. And three, we'll cancel the law against meeting with members of the PLO. That last clause is very important because they knew what they were doing was incredibly illegal. Paris and Balin, the two of them. Now, just to remind you, well, Arabs certainly, and really Orthodox Jews, they don't vote from their own conscience. They vote the way their, well, in the case of the Arabs, the way their sheikhs tell them to vote. And when, and with Orthodox Jews, very Orthodox, by the way their rabbis tell them to vote. They don't have an individual vote. If the sheikhs say you vote labor, you vote labor. And that's what Paris was counting on. And just to remind you that up until 1992, there were 17 Arab seats out of the 120 seats of the Knesset. Three different parties. Now, that's the meeting number one. Arafat has not decided in favor of this yet. So, it goes all the way to January 17th when the Americans decide to get involved for Paris. They're trying to get rid of Shamir. They want to destroy the Heirut party. Shamir was prime minister. They wanted him out. Baker, James Baker of the Council on Foreign Relations, on January 17, 1992, arrives in Cairo. And there he promises the PLO, again, you send the message through Nabil Shaat, and it gets to Arafat, who's living in Tunisia. Baker promises the American government will begin an immediate campaign to freeze settlements. And then, on January 19th, Balin is back in Cairo for the second meeting, but he got caught. He was caught by Yehoshua Meiri. He was a journalist for the Voice of Israel, Arab Affairs journalist. He speaks Arabic, and he's very respected. And, well, he was sitting in the hotel, the Ramses Hilton Hotel, when he saw Balin walk in, followed, Balin goes into a conference room.
Hold that thought, we're going to be back here in just a moment, Barry. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is, Barry Shamis, and he's talking about how this reporter sees Balin, who is a number two man or number three man under Peres, actually going into a conference room with members of the PLO, and this is, of course, illegal. I mean, Sydney, there is a law against anybody from an Israeli meeting with the PLO, and here's Balin going in, and the reporter sees him, and he's going to report this, and this is going to be very, very embarrassing for Balin because he's violated the law. He's committed an act of treason, and of course, he's really representing Peres. So pick the story up.
Well, Yehoshua Meiri, his nickname was Shuki. I still call him Shuki. We became friends after this to this very day. He was sitting in the lobby of the Ramses Hilton. That's the center of political activity in Cairo. I've been there. And he saw Balin enter a conference room followed by Nabil Shaat. He saw it with his own eyes. Now, what, he reported this, but so did, well, the main newspapers of Cairo. And when we interviewed him, he brought out the newspapers. They're called Al-Wafid and Al-Gamhuriya. They report on the meeting and more. And they went up the stakes. They wanted Arafat. The elections were coming. They were held in June of 92. They wanted to win. They could not get the Jewish vote. Labor was finished with the Jews. If they didn't have the Arab vote, they would be sitting in Parliament. Well, basically, they have 18 seats today out of 120. They have 8% of the Knesset, and half of their votes still come from the Arabs. The Jews don't want labor Zionism anymore. What Balin offered Arafat was, if you get the Arabs to vote for labor, we will give you, when we take over the government, we will allow you to build, and here's the quote, an independent, autonomous entity. The PLO will be given an independent, autonomous entity in Judea and Samaria. That's what they have right now. In other words, you support labor, we'll give you a state.
All right, hold that. We'll be back here in just a moment, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course he is telling about what the deal was. It was cooked up by Peres, a secret deal with Yasser Arafat. And the deal was, of course, if Arafat would get the Arabs of Israel to vote for the Labor Party, which Peres obviously thought would lead him into the position of being prime minister, then the Israel would do three things. One of them, of course, was to cancel the law having to do with their direct negotiation with the PLO. But the most significant thing was, of course, that they were going to allow they were going to stop building new settlements, and they were, in essence, going to give the Palestinian Liberation Organization control, for all intents and purposes, of Judea and Samaria, which, of course, was a very important area. It's only half an hour by car from Tel Aviv, and they were going to turn over this important part of Israel, without the consent of the Jewish people, without even their knowledge, through secret negotiations with Yasser Arafat. So pick the story up there, Barry.
Well, let's rehash how I met Shuki Meiri. He wrote an article in what was a pretty good magazine, newspaper called Hadashot, or News. It was from the very radically left Haaretz group, but nonetheless, in those days, the left wrote honest journalism. There's no such thing anymore as a free press in Israel. All the little journalists have been long shut down. But he wrote an article in the Chadashot called Balin's Secret Meetings, and he made this claim that he was in the Ramses Hilton and saw Balin and Schott sitting in a room together. And, well, Joel and I just said, that's it. This is a bombshell, which no one is paying any attention to. So we went to Tel Aviv and we met Shuki Meiri again. Now, back then, he was a regular Tel Avivi, a resident of Tel Aviv, very secular, very expansive. Today he is, in fact, religious. Not just religious. He was the personal aide to Rabbi Kaduri, Harav Kaduri, the most revered Sephardic rabbi of the country. He died at age 108, if you can believe this, a few months ago. Now, I'm going to do an offbeat story, but we'll return to this. When he died, Rabbi Kaduri said that the person who will save the Jews, his name is Yeshua. And I had all these Christians writing me that Rav Kaduri saw the light and he saw that Jesus was the Messiah and the Savior. I said, you don't understand Israel. Yeshua is Yeshua Meiri. It was his closest friend and ally for 10 years. Don't turn it into Jesus. That's not who he meant. And again, what these Christians don't understand is a Messiah. Kaduri spoke of a man named Yeshua who would be a Messiah. A Messiah in Judaism is not the Son of God. There's no such thing as a Son of God in Judaism. There were several messiahs in Jewish history. Shimon bar Kokhba, who fought the Romans, was rabbinically a messiah. Shabtai Tzvi, of whom we have spoken, well, we won't do Shabtai Tzvi right now, but he was viewed as a messiah. A messiah does not mean anything to do with a son of God. It means a strong leader who can unite the Jewish people. That's what a Jewish Messiah is. And my many, many Christian readers keep mixing them up, that we'll see who the Messiah is. I said, you don't understand. You'll have your Messiah, but our Messiah is not going to be God's son. He's going to be a strong man. And that's the story, in short, of Yeshua Meiri. Later on in life, he got very religious. He became chief aide to the most respected rabbi in the country. And when we met him, incidentally, he was secular. And
now this is actually the fellow you call Suki?
Yeshua Meiri or Suki?
Yes, is he? Is he or not? They're not the same person.
As who?
Suki is not Yeshua.
Sure is.
It is. Okay, fine. So
sure
I want
is.
To clarify that. So this is the former reporter, becomes a very dedicated traditional conservative Jewish leader, and now he is certainly one of the leaders of the country. But you still call him Suki.
He's not a leader of the country.
Well, he's not. What is he? Isn't he a leader of the Jewish people?
No.
No, he's not. Okay.
No. He became personal aide to the leading Sephardic rabbi of the country.
But of course, if your story is accurate, why this rabbi before he died said that this would be the Messiah.
But he meant someone to the United Jews.
Right, right.
And he thought Suki, he can't be the strong man. It's not feasible. But I just mentioned that story just to let you know who he was and who I was dealing with. I became very good friends with the Yeshua Meiri, and I appeared on his radio show many times afterwards. In short, when Joel and we're getting confused, and we'll stick back to the Oslo Accord.
All right, let's go back to Oslo and forget about Suki. Go ahead.
Yeah, Suki was our source. He was our very best source of information. He had things taped. He had the Arabic newspapers reporting on the meetings between Balin and Schott. He was the Arab affairs reporter for Ma'ariv, if I'm not mistaken, for Voice of Israel. He was a really big guy. And he told us the story of it, and other stories. He knew all about Iran, and he knew the Arab world. But he became our source for the story about Balin's visits to Sha'at on behalf of Shimon Peres. Now, when he wrote this article in Chadashot, it should have been the end of Peres. It should have been the end of Balin. But no one paid attention but me and Joel. And we thought when National Review accepted it, that would be the end of Peres. But it wasn't. They said, they were asked about it, all through the Israeli media. There are rumors that Balin went to Cairo when it was illegal and spoke to the leadership of the PLO. They said, we will not dignify ourselves by answering that question. They use the same logic when I exposed the Rabin assassination. They will not dignify themselves by answering my accusations. These people think they're in control, and they think that they have all the dignity, and I don't have dignity, and they get away with it somehow. It's breaking down quickly, but let's go back to her story, or we're getting very lost right now. All right. Balin offers Arafat a state, essentially, if he gathers the Arabs together to vote for labor. Now, a very, very unexpected thing happened. In February of 1992, Rabin wrested power of the Labor Party from Paris. And Arafat had a major problem. A lot of Palestinians hated Rabin. He was the defense minister during the Intifada, and they viewed him as rightfully, as someone who hates Arabs. Rabin did not like Arabs. And Arafat just couldn't do it. So he called a conference and invited the leaders of the three Arab parties, the Knesset parties, and he tried to get them to unite behind a PLO government. And essentially, the PLO would be inside the Knesset, and they would work together with him, and there was too much dissension. Hamas runs Gaza, and the PLO run the West Bank, and they don't get along. The same thing happened. Arafat failed. So lo and behold, Arafat gave in, and he got the village elders and the sheikhs to vote labor. And an amazing thing happened in the 1992 elections. The Arabs, who had 17 seats in the previous Knesset, only had 4. All the other Arab votes went to labor or its partner, the Rats Party. It, by the way, it was called Rats, R-A-T-Z Party. In essence, it was the PLO who was running Israel. Paris arranged a government for Rabin that the PLO, without the PLO, they could not ever have formed the government in 1992. But now you've got a big, big problem, because Rabin didn't make the promises to Arafat to create a state, to change the law against meeting the PLO. He didn't want to change it. And how do we know that? Because Rabin gave an interview to William Sapphire of the, New York Times. And he said, Oslo wasn't my idea. George Bush made me do it. And here's how that happened. Arafat has now got Rabin as prime minister, and he's not... Laborers were reneging on Paris' deal. Rabin doesn't want to give the PLO a stake. He doesn't want a land for peace diplomacy. So on September 11th, the ball game really began. It began with Dennis Ross, again through Nabushat, a letter to Arafat. Dennis Ross promises American recognition of the PLO if Israel changes the law preventing meetings with the PLO. America is going to recognize the PLO. That day they were on the terror list, leading terrorist group in the world, and overnight they were going to recognize him. Next meeting with Yossi Beilin, the 12th of September, after Ross makes his declaration. He takes a letter from Paris it's the same Nabushat, but this time he had a letter waiting for him. Arafat wrote a letter to Paris that Balin was going to deliver. That day, to Paris, in person, Arafat threatened to expose both Balin and Paris to the world. And that would have been the end of Paris and Balin. We're very sorry he didn't do it. He said, if this deal, after we went through the trouble of getting you in power and giving you 12 seats, and you're reneging, well, one, I'm going to expose you. And two, I'm going to join the Rejection Front, which the Rejection Front were the Palestinians who would not sit with Israel under any circumstances. In other words, he was going to return to terrorism like he ever left it. Nonetheless, that was the 12th of September. Next day, Mubarak, president of Egypt, sends his foreign minister, Omar Musa, to Jerusalem, and this was widely reported. It was leaked that he threatened to renege on the Camp David peace accord. He said if Rabin doesn't play ball with what Paris promised the PLO, he's going to rearm the Sinai. This is what he told Rabin. But apparently even that wasn't enough, because the real push came. Rabin was ordered to take a trip to Kennebunkport, Maine, and meet with the outgoing President Bush. September 17th of 1992, Bush orders Rabin to prepare his people. Now, these are Rabin's own words to William Sapphire. He says to prepare the Israeli people for painful sacrifices. Bush ordered Rabin to meet the PLO and cut a deal with them. Any kind of deal, but they were going to meet the PLO, and Rabin caved in. And we can speculate all we want to, but why he caved in. Rabin caved in. Now, are you still there?
I'm still here, right?
Are you following it all?
I'm following exactly what you're saying. And, of course, 3 years later, why, of course, Rabin is dead.
That's actually irrelevant a bit. But we could, one of these days we'll tie that in.
All right.
But the point is, everything that Paris and Balin promised Arafat was now coming through. On November 25th, immediately after the Oslo meetings, and we discussed that, Pundak and Hersfeld met in London and then agreed to meet in Norway to hammer out the accord. Immediately after that meeting, on November 25th, 1992, Paris colleague David Libayi, he was justice minister, introduces a law allowing not just upcoming meetings with the PLO, all past meetings. And without this law, Balin and Paris could have been sitting in prison for decades on high treason. But they're going to change the law, and they did change the law. In February of 1993, the law was changed, and all the treason that Paris and Balin had committed. And we've discussed three of Balin's meetings. The fourth one was less significant. But now they're home free. They have now got the PLO represented in the Israeli Knesset on behalf of Shimon Peres. The Labor Party was going to give the PLO a state. The Labor Party started the Oslo Accords. And everything that Peres dreamed is the nightmare that is Israel today.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with, to wrap up the program. Barry, how can people get to your books?
All right. You go to www.lulu.com. It says search in a little box. You write my name.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Pardon me?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Search in the little box at lulu.com. You spell my name, C-H-A-M-I-S-H. That's Chamish. You'll get to my books, And you'll find that they're just filled with these facts. And I want to state also that we were the me and Joel, I'm not going to take full credit. We read the article in Chadashot, met Yeshua Meiri. He shows us the tapes. He shows us the papers. He proves to us that the Israeli Labor Party were the ones who brought the PLO back to Israel to wreck the country. That's what happened. My website is BarryChamish.com. That's good enough. And if you want the DVDs, they're not sold by Lulu. One of them is the Vatican's A New Crusade for Jerusalem. Another recent one is called Take Back Israel, where I tell anyone who listens to me how to get that country back from these madmen running the country. We just described the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, was the one who betrayed his country to win an election. That's the only reason he did it, was to win the election in 1992. He brought the PLO to the country because that was the only way he could win an election. My phone number is 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. I'll send you, I have 5 or 6 DVDs. I'll send them to you if you call me.
All right, very good. Our guest has been Barry Shamish. You got 1 minute to wrap up the program, Barry.
All right, I'll see you at the conspiracy conference. Santa Clara, Marriott Hotel, June 7th and 8th. We're both going to be there. And, well, that's my message.
All right.
If you live near Santa Clara, come and I'll meet you on June 7th and 8th.
God bless. Thanks very much, Barry. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it that you gave me the chance.
We'll be with you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Fine. Well, our guest has been Barry Shamish, and certainly Barry's one of the best informed people. In fact, the history of modern Israel, but the message that you really need to get from what he says, and sometimes it's hard to follow it all. I can follow it because I usually hear it 3 times during the week. But, of course, there's a group of people in Israel who are intent upon destroying Israel, working with the American State Department. We'll be right back. Well, this is Arthur Stan. We do hope that you enjoyed the interviews with Barry Shamish. And Barry is an amazing individual. Of course, he has such a great amount of knowledge, and he's lived all of the things that he's talking about. And his information, I believe, is valid. And he recognizes, as I do, the influence of the Council on Foreign Relations on Israel, and the fact that the Council on Foreign Relations and the people who control our invisible government are really intent upon destroying the land of Israel as a sovereign nation. And I believe that's against God's plan. It's going to be interesting to see how God deals with the actions of our leaders. And perhaps the people of our country really are responsible for what our leaders are doing, because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Well, I want to mention, of course, that Barry Shamish is going to be at the conspiracy conference in the Marriott Hotel on the 7th and 8th of June, just a month from now. And I will be there on the Sunday, that's the 8th. Won't be there on the on Saturday, but of course Steve, who works with us, will be there. We'll have a table up. If you're interested in having more information about the conspiracy conference, call 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844. If you can't get that, why, of course, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's our number, and the girls there will get you the information on the conspiracy conference. It's going to be a especially good lineup this year. They're having Joyce Riley and Jim Mars, and Clifford Conacorm is going to be talking about the chemtrails. Ralph Everson will be there. Barry Shamish will be there. So there are going to be a lot of fascinating speakers. It's the best lineup I've ever seen from our point of view. You're going to find a lot of weird people there. That's the reason we go. We want to reach these weird people and help them understand the spiritual battle that's underway today. Now, of course, we recommend very strongly my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and or the DVD. They all tell the same story. The book came from the talk rather than the talk coming from the book. And then, of course, we have our talk on the forbidden knowledge, and there's a DVD that goes with that. You need to get it. I should say there's a DVD and then there's a syllabus. You need to get the information. You need to understand there is a secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years, specifically for today. And then, of course, we have our DVD called The Planned Police State, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. We have our talk on sustainable development, the road to world government, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. We have a talk called Iraq, the Untold Story, and a syllabus that goes with that that has a lot of original documentation you'll never get elsewhere, but will help you to understand that there is a plan to bring about a world government and to destroy the United States of America. And that's exactly what's going on today. They are intentionally shipping our jobs and our manufacturing overseas. They're intentionally destroying the value of our currency. They are intentionally taking the jobs away from our people, and their plan is to impoverish the American people. That's what this economic crisis is all about. And, of course, as Lenin had said so well, there's no better way to destroy a nation than to debauch its currency, and not one person in a million will know what's happening. The quotation you'll find in Alan Greenspan's book, The Age of Turbulence, but it's absolutely right. Most people do not understand what happens when you have an inflation rate. Right now we're running an inflation rate of 12%, and unless something dramatic happens, we'll be to 18% or 19% by the end of this year. And that means that one